The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Rich Greenewald, a member of the Free Libraries Foundation's Board of Directors, and I'm delighted to be here with you tonight. You know, it's been incredible to witness the growth of the Free Libraries author event series over these past 30 years. What first started out as a small offering of lectures is now a robust lineup of events with acclaimed novelists, historians, and public figures. And tonight is no exception. These discussions connect, inspire, and challenge us, addressing timely issues in the public, civic, and humanities. Through in-person events right here in this auditorium and online archives of podcasts and videos, the Authors Events Program reaches millions of people worldwide. This makes this series the single largest provider of electronic content produced and distributed by the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'd like to take the time to especially thank all of you, our members, who are with us tonight. As a member of the Pepper Society myself, I hope I can encourage many of you to continue to join us in supporting the Free Library. So many enriching programs, including this award-winning author series, are made possible through your generous support. You can find more information about becoming a member and donating in tonight's program. And now it's my great honor to introduce our guests this evening. A journalist at the New York Times for more than 25 years, Frank Bruni has been the paper's Rome bureau chief, head restaurant critic, White House correspondent, and staff writer for its Sunday magazine, among other positions. His best-selling books include Ambling into History, The Unlikely Odyssey of George W. Bush, Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater, Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania, and The Beauty of Dusk, a memoir about adjusting to suddenly losing sight in his right eye. Also currently a professor of public policy at Duke University and the writer of a popular weekly Times newsletter, Bruni formerly worked as a Pulitzer Prize-nominated writer for the Detroit Free Press. In The Age of Grievance, Bruni examines the ways in which the blame game has come to define American politics and culture. Joining Bruni on the stage this evening is Karen Heller. Heller is the former national features writer and current contributor to the Washington Post, was formerly a Metro and features columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and was a finalist for the 2001 Pulitzer Prize in commentary. We're so pleased to have them both with us this evening. So please join me in welcoming Karen Heller and Frank Bruni to the Free Library stage.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you for that introduction. That's lovely. Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us. We're all fellow Francophiles.
Well, I never heard it like that before.
That's I coined that. That's you yeah. can. I'm patenting it.
The Parisians in the audience may beg to differ, but yeah.
Well, you could be a Francophile two ways. Anyway, we're so lucky to have you here. You've had such a beautiful career, being the chief restaurant critic of the New York Times and Rome Bureau.
I think you mean incoherent career.
No, I think this is great. You're great at cocktail parties, probably. You can speak about almost anything a little bit.
I drink right? a lot.
Yeah. Anyway, he's been an op-ed columnist. He still contributes quite frequently to the Times. And what's nice about it is you get to be paid for your grievances, right? and people have to read them. Fabulous newsletter. If you don't subscribe, I really encourage you to do so. It's just terrific. Anyway, we live in a time of many riches, not only literal wealth, but amazing advancements in health, technology, bread, coffee, beer, athleisure, footwear, daily comfort and ease.
Sockwear. Yeah.
And yet how we complain. And you write that we are experiencing the oppression Olympics. The idea that my situation, even though we have great socks, my situation is so much worse than yours. I want to understand how you saw that we got to this point. You write that the United States is a nation born of grievance in the revolt of royal subjects unwilling to accept a deal, that our legal system, that grievance can be good. But how did we get to this point?
Well, I mean, that's the question that the book tries to answer. I mean, there are many answers to that. I mean, we could talk about social media. We could talk about, and we will tonight, I know, we could talk about the country's turn from a sort of trademark optimism to a whole new American pessimism, which I think is very concerning and new. There are a whole lot of ways, but what has happened to the word grievance, because you brought up correctly that we're a nation born of grievance. Grievances is a word that appears in the First Amendment. If you go back to the late 1700s, early 1800s, when people spoke of grievances, it was a term that usually meant just causes, urgent causes. Now, if you left this auditorium tonight and you did a Google search of grievance and where it has appeared in the last 24 hours of the last week, you would find it almost always is used as a pejorative, in a negative context. And that's a tell. And what that says is that we have become so incessant in our complaints, so indiscriminate in our complaints. We've jumbled the sorts of things we must complain about as a matter of fundamental justice with stuff that we needn't complain about, but that bespeaks a certain sort of spoiledness and narcissism. We've jumbled it all together in a way that I think makes constructive discourse almost impossible and completely paralyzes our political debates.
You write that almost no cultural event, no bit of news, no topic of national conversation is roped off from grievance, by which I mean a complaint or concern that should or could be a modest point of dispute, negotiable with business-like diction and business-like decorum, but is blown up widely out of proportion. I want to say that I tweeted about this event, and
somebody was aggrieved?
Yes, and said some very unkind things about the two of us, and I don't think we've met, you know, like...
Welcome to my inbox,
yeah. right. You know, and he was one of those guys like buff 089, so you don't even know if it's a bot or whatever. Well, tell me what with the genesis of that you could create a whole wonderful book from this. When did you first notice that this was sort of fomenting? Was it a slow burn? Or was there a specific moment?
I think we've all been noticing it for, you know, better than a decade now. I mean, when I put the language to it, I actually wish I could take credit for the phrase, the age of grievance, whether it's a good one or a bad one. But after I wrote my last book, which was referred to The Beauty of Dusk, which was about a kind of personal medical ordeal odyssey, I had a great experience with my editor at Avid Reader Press. I'll give a shout out to Avid Reader Press. And we thought we should do another book together. And he's a regular reader of my newsletter and other things I write. And he sent me an email one day and he said, I think it was right after I had made fun of Ginny Thomas's text messages to the White House about how this election was being stolen. And it had a lot of capital letters, and wow, did it have a lot of exclamation points, right? And the theme of it was what came through in her text messages was how oppressed she felt, how cheated she felt.
And let's stop for a minute.
Ginny Thomas,
okay,
right,
okay.
You know.
Just want to make sure we're talking
I mean,
about the
what?
Same
one. You know, the free Winnebago wasn't big enough, you know. I love that this audience got that reference. Thank you. Thank you. This is the guy, yeah. And I think it was after that newsletter, my editor, Ben Lunin, wrote me an email. And the sum of it was, I think you should write a book called The Age of Grievance. And I wrote back and I said, I think we need to make sure we hear the same thing before we proceed. But in that phrase, I started thinking about it and I thought that really is a great distillation and summary of this sort of culture of complaint we live in, of this culture that fetishizes victimization and makes people want to come into the public square and say, I'm a victim. Chris Rock said something very brilliant in his most recent stand-up, Selective Outrage. He was talking about, he was listing the top ways in which people want to be noticed, right? And it was a mixture of jokes and serious things. And I think he said, you know, way number three, by being a victim, you know? And then he said it very well, I would encourage people watching Selective Outrage. He said, there are many real victims among us, and they deserve our recognition, and they deserve our empathy, and they deserve our assistance and help. And he said, but there are so many people claiming victimization in situations where it is not warranted. He said, we basically have an emergency room full of people with paper cuts.
A brilliant line.
And I quote him in the book because, frankly, that's the whole book, and so now you've heard that phrase and we can all go home.
Right. So paper. I love that, a nation of paper cuts. So did you have a moment of clarity or frustration? Your editor had this idea, but did you say, oh, yeah, I've got to... I mean, you've written columns on this, so was there a tipping point? Was there just a moment that you could say, yes, there's a book here, there's...
I don't know what the tipping point was, but I will tell you there was hesitation. Mm-hmm. And there's hesitation in me even as I sit here with you, whom I respect and thank for doing this in a friendly face, and even though I assume it's a mostly friendly audience, but I guess we'll find out as the evening goes on. My hesitation, because I think there's something really difficult about having this conversation that I tried really hard in the book to get right, but I don't know if I did, which is it's really important to recognize and talk about, as I do in the book, that this impulse to define yourself by how you've been wronged, to shout about how you've been wronged as loudly as possible with the idea that they who shout the loudest and use the most hyperbolic language win the day. This impulse to name who's wronged you and chart a revenge against that person or those people, this exists across the political spectrum, and I felt it was very important not only to talk front and center about the MAGA movement and what happened on January 6th, which I refer to as the grievance prom, and I think that's what it was, But it also exists on the left, and it's important to call that out too. My hesitation, and to me the great challenge in having these conversations, is while it is a pan-partisan phenomenon, that does not mean it's equivalent on the right and the left. I believe it poses a much greater danger on the right right now. It is on the right that you see the preponderance of organized political violence. It is on the right that you see the pervasive and profound election denialism at a scale that you don't see on the left. So I mostly had hesitation because I wanted to be very fair-minded and to call this out in all the places it exists without doing a sort of facile both sides-ism or implying any false equivalence.
Right. You know, you talk about how people have started to vote not so much for a candidate but against one, you know, rather than having, you know, a real belief that this person can represent you and contain, you know, your values and whatever, we're kind of negative voting. And I'd like you to read about this pessimism about America's promise.
Okay. All right. I have to put on my eyes. And hopefully I have the right page bookmarked. American dream, American exceptionalism, land of opportunity, endless frontier, manifest destiny. Those were the pretty phases, the pretty phrases that I grew up with, words that appeared not only in political ads, but also in history lessons and elevated analyses of the American psyche. We welcomed newcomers, or at least didn't tightly seal our borders, because we weren't as worried as other countries might be about having enough to go around. We were always making more. We were always making better. We were inventors, expanders, explorers. Putting the first man on the moon wasn't just a matter of bragging rights, though it was indeed that, and we bragged plenty about it. It was also an act of self-definition, an affirmation of American identity. We stretched the parameters of the navigable universe the way we stretch the parameters of everything else. That perspective obviously was a romanticized one, achieved through a selective reading of the past. It discounted the experiences of many Black Americans. It minimized the degree to which they and other minorities were shut out from all this inventing, all this expanding, all this exploring. It mingled self-congratulatory fiction with fact, and it probably imprinted itself more strongly on me than on some of my peers because of my particular family history. My father's parents were uneducated immigrants who found in the United States what they left Southern Italy for: more material comfort, greater economic stability and a more expansive future for their children, including my father, who got a scholarship to an Ivy League school, went on to earn an MBA, and became a senior partner in one of the country's biggest accounting firms. He put a heated in-ground pool in the backyard. He put me and my three siblings in private schools. He put our mother in a mink. And he pinched himself all the while. It was nonetheless true that the idea of the United States as an unrivaled engine of social mobility and generator of wealth held sway with many Americans who expected their children to do better than they'd done and their children's children to do even better. That was the mythology, anyway. I don't detect that optimism around me anymore. I see a crisis of confidence. I see retrenchment. I see manifestations of and metaphors for our lost bravado that are so on the nose they could be a playwright's invention. Take our fitful and beleaguered attempt to get back to the moon in the late summer and fall of 2022. Although Neil Armstrong, an American, had made that giant leap for mankind more than a half century earlier in 1969, NASA struggled to send an unmanned spacecraft moonward. That vessel, the Orion, rolled out to its launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on August 17th, 2022, but only after a series of delays caused by problems discovered during pre-flight tests. People then gathered on August 29th to watch Orion rocket into space, but NASA canceled the launch at the last minute due to a faulty engine temperature reading. On September 3rd, the launch was canceled yet again. This time, the culprit was a leak during fueling. Not until November 16th would Orion take off. It was as if we just couldn't defy gravity the way we used to.
Thank you. That was wonderful. So this pessimism, it's seeped in. You sort of see it in your book. You talk a lot about, you see it in all these aspects. And what do you think has fueled so much of this?
Well, part of it is a reaction to actual circumstances. I mean, in an age when we kind of invent a lot of problems and indulge a lot of false news or whatever you want to call it, we don't have the social mobility we used to. We're living in a period. There are other periods in the past when it's been severe, but we are living in a particular period of exaggerated income inequality. That's part of it. Part of it is also we're kind of a mature civilization. That makes it sound like we're grown-ups. We're not acting like grown-ups. I mean mature in the different sense. And I think at a certain point, the American promise of better, more, bigger, it kind of bumps up against the limits of the universe, so to speak. But I think the best illustration of just how much the American psychology has changed. For decades now, I think it goes back to the 70s, I pinpointed in the book, the Gallup organization has several times a year, three or four times a year, taken a very particular poll that asks Americans if they are generally satisfied with the country and with their lives in the country. Up until 2004, the answers, it would go above 50%, sometimes above 60%, it would go below, it would go like this. It was constantly changing, but always returning at various times above 50%. Since 2004, never have 50% or more Americans answered that they're generally satisfied. For 20 years running, we can't get to a majority of Americans in that Gallup survey saying that they're generally satisfied. And more often than not, the number is below 40% or below 30%. Right after January 6, 2021, it was 11%. That's 20 years of sustained negative assessments, of sustained negative thinking, and that has taken a toll.
Right. Well, I personally think we overpoll. That's the other thing. You react to the poll, you know, particularly in an election year. And we are fixated on what's wrong. And I want to talk a little bit
about...
And
we includes the media.
Yeah. Oh, yes. We'll get to that in a second. But anger is something we all have, right? It's a natural emotion. You know, all you have to do is get behind a wheel in a car and you're running late, right? And you're mad at people. But I wonder why anger has become such a dominant force in the American dialogue, and what contributed to all of this? Because most of us were raised in a certain way to be polite. You can go to places and you're slighted. You know, talking about the Chris Rock comment of paper cuts, but ultimately we know life, it's pretty good. But now it's just this anger and this righteousness and the feeling of wronged. And you talk about first the polling and feeling that the American experiment has gone kind of off the tracks. But why has anger become such, it's so acceptable? And most of us were not raised to, you know, raise our voices we didn't have Twitter, but to tell two people you don't know how horrible they are. What contributed to all of this?
I don't know. Maybe children are being raised differently now. I mean, it's interesting. You said angry behind the wheel of the car. I mean, we're living in a moment where, so we've had road rage for a long time, right? We're now living with air rage, restaurant rage, retail rage. It's like gone well, way beyond what happens on a crowded freeway. I mean, there are a lot of reasons. I think social media is a big part of it. People have seen on social media that the more furious they are, the more negatively impassioned they are, the more viral their posts go, the more they're shared, et cetera, and that becomes that creates an incentive structure for anger and for its, you know, upsizing into rage. Politicians have seen that, they've exploited that, and they've modeled that, right? You know, you sometimes when people were saying over recent weeks, you know, when they were looking at, I mean, the campus protests are a complicated subject, which we often don't treat that way, which bothers me. But looking at some of the protests that have clearly gone off the rails, that have dipped into violence, and, you know, I've seen commentators say, you know, where do these young people get the sense that confrontation of this sort is appropriate, that these sort of provocations work? And I'm thinking, I don't know, U.S. Congress?
Like, right.
I mean, I'm joking, but it's serious. I remember, this made so much sense, but it made me so sad. I remember shortly after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, I was sitting with a prominent Democratic politician, whom I will not name, because it was an off-the-record encounter, and I don't think I'm breaking that here. And this politician said, and this politician is known for his, her, or their measured tone and for being a conciliator.
Oh,
and
so it wasn't Bernie Sanders. Go ahead.
It was not him, and it was not Elizabeth Warren. And this politician said, you know, Donald Trump and his allies do such a good job of making people angry and whipping them into ever greater fury and getting to the polls. This could be really good for us. Now we can make our voters as angry, right? Now, tactically, I thought it was a very smart statement. You know, and as someone who fervently advocates for reproductive rights, I was on his side, but it just made me really sad as a kind of reflection of the times that he was excited about the opportunity to sow and reap anger. That was the smart move was really disturbing. And of course it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and a self-feeding loop or whatever that right phrase is.
Right. So we might as well get into it. You call Trump cast himself as both a martyr and a messiah. He was a grudge made flesh. Grievance became president. And you talk about us being in the Grievance Olympics, and he may be the gold medal winner in this.
Oh, yeah. He's like the Michael Phelps of the Grievance
right,
Olympics.
Right, right. Why does this play so well? I mean, tell me, we have social media. Why? It's just when you stand back from it, you just... You know, if somebody showed.
Well, we're not standing back from it. I mean, you just said the crucial thing. Too few of us are standing back from it. Too few of us are pausing and saying before we begin shouting or before we just kind of accept that everybody else is shouting. Too few of us say, what is this doing to us? Where are we going? Is there a different way? Like, this is costing us so very much. And the part of the book that's most important to me are the chapters and pages that look at that, you know, at how it's degraded our country. But, you know, I don't think we're self-reflective in the right way, but there are a lot of streams that come to this confluence. We've become a much more self-centric, narcissistic people. You know, we've gone from self-actualization to self-care to all of this attention on how do I make me better. And I don't hear the same amount of attention being given or passion being lavished on the collective good. I think social media divides us. I think media in general and the internet divides us. I mean, you go back to when you and I were growing up. And if you wanted to watch TV news, your choices were ABC, NBC, CBS, or depending on where you lived, maybe there was a PBS channel that did that. That was it, right? And it was maybe half an hour, maybe 1 hour. And so they tried to do general interest stuff, and they were bound for many decades by the fairness doctrine, on and on. Compare that to the cable news universe of today, where you get to tune in mm-hmm. to exactly what you want to hear, to the exclusion of all other viewpoints, which of course only ends up not just confirming what you believe, but ossifying it. I think it is so telling, so scary, and so important to go back to why did Fox News settle with Dominion Voting Systems for $787.5 million, right? By far a record. Why did they do that? Because things were going to go worse if it came to a trial. They did that because in discovery it was shown that top Fox News anchors, top Fox News executives, knew and were talking with one another about the fact that they were putting these lies on the air about rigged voting machines and a corruption of the voting process. But what they were saying to one another was, if we don't air this, our audience will just go over to One America News or some other station that will air it. So we have to give them what they're looking for, lest we disappoint them, even if it's not the truth. Right? Now, that is the most extreme example, but versions of that happen throughout the media universe because we have this whole new ability to curate the facts we receive, which often aren't facts, the information we get, and each one of us is living in a different version of reality right. from the person to our left and the person to our right. That is an enormous, enormous problem and a great wellspring of anger.
Right. Now, that's true. And I mean, I know people who will say, like, all Republicans are horrible people. And I'm going, you really want to say that? We don't do this professionally. That's an absurdity. If you change that to somebody's skin color.
Right.
Yeah. Think about that. I mean, you just reminded me of one thing. Speaking of anger and grievance, there was a terrific story. I think Jane Mayer did it in the New Yorker years ago about how Rupert Murdoch bought the rights to NFL because he was Australian. He didn't care about American football, but because he knew the anger and the attachment to watching sports, they would already have this sort of fevered, you know, how men can get, sorry, making a generalization, men can get, I guess women can too, but get riled up watching sports. And he knew that that was going to be a secret. So you made me think about that.
Interesting.
That was one of the building blocks of Fox News was owning the NFL rights. He said, I don't care what it costs, because I know we're going to have impassioned. I want to just flip this a little bit and talk about victimhood, which to me is so fascinating because I'm looking around the room and most of us are a similar age, and you grow up with profiles in courage and the idea of being brave, and you think of John F. Kennedy or George H.W. Bush and people who served in wars, and the idea of being a victim, you know, was just heresy. I mean, Nora Ephron famously said, never be the victim of your own story. And now we have somebody like Donald Trump, but other people as well, who grew up with everything and yet paints himself as a victim. And I still cannot wrap my head around how this became attractive politically.
No, but I mean, you bring up the right thing. Victimhood has become a kind of political currency like never before. And you're right. I mean, it's the cornerstone of his entire political identity. It works. I mean, this is a sort of like he is both the result of a mindset and he is the accelerant and the multiplier of a
Correct.
Mindset. But it worked for him because there were all of these people in America who felt like victims. And he was basically saying, I'm your symbol. You feel like victims and you've identified your victimizers. And guess what? Those are the people who say I have no business doing this, who look down on me, who speak of me in the most mocking and derogatory ways. And so by getting behind me, you're getting back at them. This was his political pitch on some level from the very beginning, and he kind of distilled it perfectly about a year and a quarter ago when, kicking off this current campaign, he said, I am your retribution. What that meant was your ultimate revenge against all of those elites who are oppressing you is to saddle them with me again, you know?
It's just extraordinary. I mean, again, if you went in the Wayback Machine, really say victimhood, you know, that was not something.
But this isn't the first time, though. As I mentioned in the book, what's interesting is it went away for a while and then it came back. But if you go back and you look at a lot of the cultural conversation in the late 80s and the early 90s, and I document this at some length, it sounds so much like today. It just has a different vocabulary. So Robert Bork at the time was inveighing against radical egalitarianism. When you hear him define that, you realize he's talking about what we now call wokeism, right? The same tensions existed then, but then they kind of broke for a while, and now they're back in even more intense, exacerbated form.
So I wanted the wonderful point. I want to talk about something you write about. It's the U.S. is an envy engine. It's sort of a nation of the have everythings, and we see that Bravo, a whole channel, you know, that's dedicated, devoted to people who seem to have everything and the want everythings but can't, right? And, you know, we can blame social media, obviously, but again, an accelerant. It wouldn't work if there was an audience for it. Anyway, there just seem to be so many ways to be miserable, annoyed, and angered, and I would love if you would read about these sort of microclimates of privilege.
Yeah, I think something has happened in our service economy that is a piece of this puzzle. When I was a teenager in the late 1970s and early 1980s, okay, you can do the arithmetic, I'm 59. When I was a teenager in the late 1970s and early 1980s and went to the big concerts of major performers, different sections of seating had different prices, but they fell into a few general categories. A person's proximity to the stage often had less to do with her financial reserves than with how quickly and heroically she'd acted to get her tickets. I once showed up at the box office of what was then called the Hartford Civic Center at 3 a.m. in pitch darkness to be in place when tickets for a Queen concert went on sale several hours later. That was the surest path to the best seats. My friends and I ended up in the 8th row, where I caught Freddie Mercury's tambourine when he threw it into the crowd at the conclusion of the band's final song. And there was something egalitarian about it. But the seating maps for various stops on Taylor Swift's 2023 tour revealed scores and scores of price tags, tailored with extreme specificity to the precise desirability of the vantage point. The highest ones were many thousands of dollars above the lowest ones. A family of 4 or 5 posting photos of themselves among other ecstatic Swifties as showtime neared was in some cases announcing to the world its ability to drop $10,000 or more on one night's entertainment. But while the price range for Swift exceeded the price range for a garden variety superstar, the exacting tiering of the experience was a common phenomenon in the world of live music. When I was a teenager, school essentially came in 2 sizes, public or private. Now, private is the starting point, with many costly but broadly applied add-ons, the tutors for special subjects, the separate tutor for standardized exams, the individual sports coach, the independent college admissions consultant who, for a hefty fee, does more plotting and pacifying than the counselors already on the school staff are able to. When I was a teenager, you were posh if you belonged to a private gym versus, say, the YMCA. The brand of that gym and the level of your membership weren't relevant. Now, Planet Fitness and Equinox are solar systems of pampering apart. And at some of the equinoxes of the galaxy, different clients pay significantly different sums for personal trainers in accordance with that ab whisperer's determined gradation of expertise. Those clients can also pay a surcharge for a better locker room, a surcharge for certain other sanctums. And none of that is unnoticed by or unnoticeable to the other customers. Its noticeableness is perhaps part of the point. Aspiration and perspiration go together. The emphasis of the American economy may have changed over the years from manufacturing to services, but one product we make in abundance is distinctions.
That's terrific. Yet I think we've always had these caste systems, obviously. I mean, you know, there was actually people came over in boat in steerage, and people came over in boats in worse than that. But I think we're
Kate
all
Kate Winslet and Leo were in different sides of the Titanic.
That's right. Yeah. And there was slavery. But now we're also made aware, and you see sort of the degradation or the privilege is the point, right?
It's crazy. I mean, we have done this sort of like fine-grained tiering of the service economy. Think about the airport. You know, think about, I begin the chapter that passage appears in, imagining the Joneses and the Johnsons going to Disney World, and how from the moment they arrive at the airport to the moment they get to the amusement park, every aspect of their experience is different. The Joneses have paid at every juncture to just glide through everything, and the Johnsons are on long lines. I mean, if you go to an amusement park today, there are these people who, while you're sweating in the sun, waiting hours for Space Mountain, are zooming to the front because they've paid for some, I think it's called the Genie Pass, right? There was no Genie Pass when I was growing up. And I think it is one of the existence of this sort of tiering, these sort of microclimates of exclusivity and privilege, I think are really potent engines of envy that explain some of the anger we're talking about.
Yeah. Another thing is that everyone has a take, right? You know, everyone has an opinion on everything. Like, the minute that Taylor Swift...
I've never had an opinion.
Never. No. You get paid. That's a great thing. Or, you know, I've read so many takes on Taylor Swift or Beyonce. It's like we overanalyze things to death. But it's sort of a, you know, an exhausting array of beefs. But before we get to questions, I want to have a little bit of hope, I'm sure some of these questions, about some of the remedies for this that you mentioned in the book, if you could share with.
I'd be glad to, thank you. But I also want to say Taylor Swift gives me hope, seriously. If you look at what a phenomenon her concert tour became, and if you think about how many people you knew who were going to it, and if you think about how interested diverse people were in being kind of fluent in Taylor Swift. She's a phenomenally talented human being, but that was about so much more than her talent. What I saw in that was such a fierce desire to have a common conversation, to have something we could all talk about. She was a sort of water cooler show that no longer exists. And I saw, I hear 60-year-olds, I hear 6-year-olds talking about Taylor Swift. And in their desire to talk about her and in the joy with which they talk about her, part of what I hear is this real yearning to once again be kind of reading from a common playbook, to be having a shared conversation. So I think there's a lot of hope in that. How do we get to that shared conversation? I think there are all sorts of things we can do across many different fronts of life that we're just not committing to. There are political reforms we need to do away with gerrymandering. We need to think about the way our primaries are set up and how they reward extremist candidates. There was a great story in the New York Times within the last 3 weeks, some of you will probably remember it better than I do, and I can't remember the precise timing, which looked at what has happened in Michigan over the last 5 years in terms of pushing back against gerrymandering, in terms of making the state more representative and not a model for minority rule. And all of those things happened because of citizen movements and because of the passion and persistence of voters themselves. That needs to happen in more states. That's a really, really hopeful story. We need to do things in terms of the way, whether it comes to how we spend government money, how we design cities. We need to incentivize people from diverse backgrounds crossing paths rather than doing what's happening now, which is being sorted ever more narrowly into enclaves that never interact with each other. We can incentivize those things with certain kinds of government action, certain kinds of spending. We're in a library. Right? I write about libraries in the book because I think they're one of the last bastions where you actually, if you go to a library, you run into a lot of people who don't look exactly like you, who aren't the same age, who don't make the same amount of money. It is tragic how few environments like that exist, but we can invest in public buildings, public spaces. There's a great book, I'm going to mispronounce his last name. There's a reason I write and don't do TV, because I can't pronounce anything. But Eric Kleinenberg wrote a great book a couple years ago called Palaces for the People. And it's all about the power of investing in public spaces and public structures. That's another thing we could do. Last thing I'll say, many politicians have talked about a national service program. People kind of think that's never going to happen because if we made it compulsory, it would never happen. You can have a national service program that is not compulsory, but that has such elegant incentives built in that, in fact, you get a critical mass of people to do it. We need to think more about that than we have.
Great. And one last thing, then we'll go to questions, is about humility. You end with that. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think part of what we're experiencing is a crisis of humility. The idea too many people believe that they are right and everybody else is wrong. That is unhumble. Too many people think the world, society, politics should conform precisely to their liking. That is not the way life works, and that's unhumble. I mentioned January 6th before, the grievance prom. When you look at that day, what we saw was violent, it was frenzied, it was savage. I think above all, it was unhumble. Because those people were basically saying, if the country voted differently from us, well, then that's the wrong way, and we're gonna get the result that is the right result by any means necessary. But as many of them couldn't fathom that a majority of people in the country would vote differently than they had, and therefore it must be a lie, it must be rigged, that is profoundly unhumble.
Wonderful point. I think we're going to go to questions now.
This is a little off topic, but would you mind sharing just one story about your dog?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, how to pick. Thank you for that. Not all of you know this, but I spend an inordinate amount of syllables in my newsletter on my dog. And she's very photogenic, don't you think? I don't think I've ever written this, but she has this wonderful habit, which only lasts about 5 minutes, when she's very happy and excited, when we play fetch with her favorite rope ring. She goes and she fetches it, and then as she's bringing it out, she's bringing it back, she takes several pauses to throw it in the air to herself and to catch it again. And then in her joy, she falls to the earth and she does sideways somersaults. And if there's a neighbor watching, they always say, oh my gosh, that means she's rolling in shit, you've got to stop her. But she's not, she's just joyously doing somersaults. She's like Simone Biles or something.
Hi. So, first off, it was a fantastic talk. I really appreciate it. I was born in 1998. I'm of the younger generation that's here. And I thought that it was interesting you talking about how since, I think, 2004, people's satisfaction with the country has been steadily decreasing. I think something that me and my friends think about a lot is that our generation hasn't really had, like, a rallying event, whether that be a war or kind of, like, national experience. And it was interesting you talking about Taylor Swift's tour as this kind of like most recent phenomena that really rallies a group of people. I was curious if you've found in looking back that what has rallied people most often are those types of like national tragic events, whether that be a war or attack or something like that, or if there are other pieces of pop culture that you've seen over time that really unites the country in this kind of like common conversation.
Thank you. I don't know that I have an answer to all of that, but I have an observation that kind of fits into your question and maybe is a partial answer. You know, you go back to September 11th, to 9/11, right? And you definitely saw the country rally after that. And you saw a period, several weeks, maybe even more than a month, when George W. Bush, who was then president, when his approval ratings were above 85%. I think there was even a poll or two where he was above 90%. I would bet a lot of money that in our lifetimes, we're never going to see an American president have an approval rating over 65%, maybe not even over 60%, because we've become so much more unyieldingly partisan and tribal. When the COVID pandemic came along, in the beginning we were calling it the coronavirus pandemic, it was clear at the start, and there's a lot that wasn't clear, but it was clear that this was, you know, that it was a pandemic, that it was global, that the magnitude was immense, and that this was something that could threaten everyone and do extraordinary damage that would be long-lasting. I waited for people not to come together in quite the way they did after 9/11, but I waited for and kind of expected to see, okay, we're gonna see some at least pale echo of that sort of national solidarity. And in fact, if anything, became like a partisanship accelerant. And I think it's a good indication of how much has changed. I'm not sure, given how politically tribal we've become, given how ruthlessly sorted we've been by the internet and social media, given the examples that our politicians are setting, which are not good examples, I'm not sure one of those sorts of events you refer to would do today what it has done historically. And that makes me really sad.
Yeah, I thought January 6th had the potential because both Republicans and Democrats were threatened. Mike Pence was, and it didn't happen.
That's an even better example. No, in fact, immediately it became dueling narratives, right?
Right.
Thank you, Frank, for being here. Just a quick question, which is, you know, you mentioned about ossified media. You said you're not a TV guy, but you know, I assume you're at least trying to get on Fox to at least promote the book. Right. So,
you say I should go on Fox?
Yeah, exactly. You should.
I haven't gone on Fox.
No, yeah, they ask you?
Right, they haven't asked me, so I haven't had that moral dilemma.
But in the, but that's what I was gonna. If you were asked, you know, would you go, and how do you think you'd be treated on a right wing media ecosystem?
That's a great question. If asked, I would go, and I will tell you why I would go. I mean, would I like to sell more books? Sure. I'm a human being.
I want to interrupt to say that he's number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list.
But yes, I'd like to sell more books because I have utility bills and Regan needs her gourmet kibble, right? I would go on Fox for the same reason I believe that Pete Buttigieg goes on Fox, or that Ro Khanna goes on Fox. I don't think we're served by not speaking to the people who disagree with us. In fact, I think when we avoid speaking with the people who disagree with us, we just ensure that they will continue to see us in caricature and vilify us and assume that we want to have nothing to do with them and are not interested in a potentially productive conversation, even if the odds of that are slim. How would I be treated? I don't know. But I would say the same things I said here tonight. You know, I would certainly say that I have criticisms of the left, and they're abundant in the book. But I would certainly say that I think the right now has more to answer for. And I would feel free to bring up the Dominion voting system suit. And at that point, my guess is we go to commercial break, and the segment would be over.
He is going on Bill Maher, who's getting more conservative by the week. So,
this is sort of an unformed question. I'm crazy about you. I'm crazy about Regan.
I should have brought Regan.
I know.
You know, she came to Philadelphia once for like just a kind of vacation weekend. She's very good in a hotel, and I have beautiful pictures of her on the Rocky Steps. I do. No, I do. Yeah.
Now I've totally forgotten what I was going to say.
That was the strategy. That was my plan. Right. Yeah.
And she was praising you.
So I'm a retired Presbyterian minister, and if I were still in the pulpit, you would be in my sermon next Sunday on humility. That column in the New York Times was incredible, and you often were in my sermons when I was preaching. But I'm also an English major, and so I'm wondering what your next book would be. So I see your last chapter are, okay, what are my solutions or my thoughts? But if you would write a whole book, you're teaching now, and words are so important. And the thing I love about your newsletter are sentences, the sentences you have in the newsletters. And so the sentences of humility, like how do we teach ourselves again to speak in a way that is invitational, that listens, you know, if you were, like, you're probably already writing your next book, but I'd like your next book to be, like, on humility, and I'm just saying.
It's funny you say that. I have not committed to my next book. I do have a fairly developed idea, but I will tell you that about 6 months ago, I said to my agent, the thing on humility you read in the Times was from the book. It was words from the book. And I said to my agent, you know, as I wrote the book, the chapter that meant the most to me was the final one on humility. And I really wanted to kind of sit and stay with that longer. I think my next book should be on humility. And she said, no one will buy it. Next idea.
Oh, that's so funny.
So maybe I should go back to her, but I was on Team Humility until I was slapped down. But, you know, I think just to give you a slightly more serious answer and then to move on, I think some of the things that we don't teach adequately in school are, in fact, vessels for humility. I think when you teach history in the proper way, you are teaching people to be humble. You are reminding them that their moment in time exists in a much larger context and is informed by everything that came before. When you teach citizenship and civic duty in a correct way, you're teaching humility. So I would like to see us get back to some of those things which sound like some curmudgeon's kind of fussy wish list, but I think they're really fundamental to civic health.
I want to ask you about a grievance that's gotten a lot of attention recently. The president apparently isn't real happy with the New York Times. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
So you're talking about, well, I mean, the president isn't unhappy with the New York Times for a number of reasons. So seriously, what exactly?
Well, there was a widely reported story that the Times was mad at the president.
They were mad about access, yeah.
About access, yeah. That he wouldn't do an exclusive interview with the Times.
Well, actually, now, I mean, I'm not, I should say here, I write regularly for the Times, I'm not on staff, and even when I was on staff, I'm not privy to the discussions and the details at the highest levels, and I don't speak for the news organization. My understanding of what happened there is they were complaining, I'm sure it was out of self-interest, and I'm sure they wanted the interview to be with the Times, but they were complaining more widely about the lack of media interviews Biden has done, period, about the fact that he ranks near the bottom of recent presidents, if not at the bottom, in terms of doing press conferences, in terms of doing interviews with independent, large, you know, the most venerable news organizations. And they're right about that. And I think they are right to bring that up, and they're right to press about that as a matter of democracy, not as a matter of Times self-interest. So if the president's unhappy with the Times because they're saying you're not being transparent and interacting enough with the media, I'm going to take the Times' side there. Is it everything? Does it mean we should all go out and vote for Donald Trump? Not my opinion. But I think it's a legitimate thing to bring up. And I think it's important. I thought you were going to go somewhere else with this question. There's been a lot of debate since the beginning of the week when Joe Kahn, the executive editor of the Times, gave an interview to Semaphore. And the question seemed to be like, are you abetting a possible victory by Donald Trump and thus essentially doing an unpatriotic thing by covering Biden critically? And he was saying no. And I'm on his side with that too. Again, not because I'm worried for my job or whatever. We will have no credibility and no voice when we criticize a politician, be it Donald Trump or any other politician, if we openly sugarcoat and censor ourselves in the interests of a given outcome. I believe, in terms of things I write, I believe that when I occasionally weigh in on Joe Biden's age and say that it is not ideal for him as a candidate right now, that it's hurting him, and that it is giving some voters pause, I get readers emailing me saying, how dare you? Do you want another 4 years of Trump? No, I don't. But I'm not paid to work for either campaign, and I believe I'll have more credibility when I weigh it in against something if I'm honest about the shortcomings as well as the virtues of the person I may end up voting for. I thought that's where you were going to go, and I wish people would understand that journalists are not campaign aides. And if they start becoming campaign aides, that is not going to lead anywhere good.
Thank you very much for your remarks. You've done a great job of describing the uniqueness of American politics and grievance in America today. Has grievance metastasized to other countries?
I'm going to answer, because I know we're going to run out of time. I'm going to answer that in one word: Brexit. But yes, I mean, throughout Western democracies, but, you know, I mean, we had an echo of January 6th in Brazil. In fact, we had something happen that was exactly the same, almost. I mean, pretty much exactly the same. In many Western European countries and Central European countries, you see the very same tensions you see here between a MAGA-style populism driven by grievance and other forces. So, yeah, this goes beyond the United States. I think we are the most intense and fascinating laboratory for grievance.
We're number one.
Yeah, we're number one. But no, I mean, for reasons we should sort of be proud of, this is a country that makes grand promises, right? That's part of what's so special about it. But with grand promises comes the very real possibility for disappointment, right? And I think that's part of what we're seeing here. Our very kind of aspirations and ideals become a problem when we fall short of them. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have them, and it certainly doesn't mean we shouldn't keep striving toward them. But it is one of the explanations for why I think we're so quick to feel frustrated and so quick to feel shortchanged, because our country promises so much.
Okay. This goes back to the question about, was there some big event that should have brought us together? And what came to mind for me was the 2008 mortgage crisis, where what happened was that, you know, the country was on the brink, and they bailed out the rich people, you know, the bankers, which kind of needed to happen, but then didn't help the regular homeowners who were underwater, and, you know, you couldn't refinance because you couldn't, you know, show that you couldn't refinance to lower your mortgage rate. So I feel like that generated a lot of resentment and anger that set aside, like, oh, those people and everybody else is left behind. So I'm just wondering, yeah, if you feel like that's contributed to that was early days of the beginning of the resentment.
Agree entirely, and I talk about 2008 in the book. You're absolutely right, and you described it exactly perfectly. I mean, remember, 2008 is what begat the Tea Party, and in some sense, the Tea Party is what begat the MAGA movement. And I say that in a way, like, there may be aspects and certainly manifestations these days and a portion of the MAGA movement that strikes many of us as absolutely bonkers and reprehensible. But if we're trying to understand how it got there and the full movement, we need to acknowledge what you just acknowledged. It didn't emerge from just madness. There are there are socioeconomic reasons. There are the way the government responded to a crisis reasons. There are real reasons why that ended up being. And if we were a little bit better about understanding and acknowledging that, we might have a better and more productive, constructive response to it that could lead us to a healthier moment.
Thank you, Frank Rooney.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.